Bristol Community FM 93.2.
And who's trying to call me here? American 11, are you trying to call?
Nobody moves. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any move, you'll danger yourself and the airplane. Let's stay quiet.
Roger's weapon, Sergeant Powell.
Hi, Boston Center TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to, we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Canadian professor and author of, they may say, wonderful book about the exploitation and genocide in North America by John Cabot's successors and the Merchant Venturers. The book is Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization and Capitalism. It's Anthony Hall. With me, Tony Gosling. Distraction politics, the trumped-up wall. Although the evidence is it will make little difference, it's become Trump's touchstone policy. He was elected to build it, but aren't the Republicans all for minimal government? A shutdown suits them nicely. Is the shutdown just a sneaky way to bring in Republican policies that would otherwise be impossible to get away with? Part of a wider agenda, maybe, both sides of the Atlantic and beyond, to shut down and bankrupt democratic governments and hand us over to the oligarchy, ruled by banksters and big business. And whatever happened to the Minsk Agreement? Fake news on the BBC World Service. Their reporter Jonah Fisher says that Russia and Ukraine are at war. Could you believe that? What does he base this on? And what happens when he's questioned about his claim? And the Israel lobby. Former New Yorker international relations academic Ron Mendel is a new arrival here in Bristol. We talked to him about the hidden Israeli influence on media and politics, both sides of the Atlantic. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon. This week, it's Stonehenge, Glastonbury, and even Ingleston Common in Yate. How are they all connected? Well, we speak to Brig Ubridge, who was on the peace convoy for many years, and then he ended up starting something called the Big Green Gathering. He takes us through that history of travellers from the 1960s, 70s and 80s. So I'm joined on the line from Lethbridge, Alberta, I believe, by Anthony Hall. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Great to be here, Tony. Thanks for inviting me.
Can you just give us, first of all, a little bit of introduction to yourself? What got you interested in history, particularly colonialism, and ending up writing this book about colonization, decolonization, and capitalism?
Well, I became very fascinated with Indian country, the reality that First Nations who dominated the Western Hemisphere in 1492, you know, have been pushed to the margins and yet still are here, the languages still can be spoken, and so I started to look into that history. And of course, in order to look into that history, you have to look into, say, church archives, records, military records. You have to learn a lot of history to understand how this relations with First Nations developed. Increasingly, I saw this as part of a global story. I started looking at very particular situations in Canada, then thought I have to broaden it out to North America. And after all, many of the peoples in the world could be considered indigenous peoples, and most of the world has been colonized by, for instance, the British Empire and ships going out of Bristol. Anyway, there's a large pattern there. And the global war on terror is sort of the latest initiative of this imperial trajectory. And I've tried to put it all together in a big kind of global picture, Earth into property, colonization, decolonization, and capitalism.
Now, why do you use this expression, Earth into property? What does that mean?
Well, I think it's quite evocative. When you think of the Western Hemisphere in 1492, it wasn't considered property. There was no system to evaluate it and mortgage it and sell it. So how we have transformed our Earth into morsels, into fragments, into pieces of private property. We can think about, you know, the Earth itself and real estate. We can think about mortgages. We can think about insurance. We can think about futures. We can think about the stock market. It's really amazing how innovative we have been as humanity, especially the trajectory of capitalist humanity, in dividing up the world into pieces of property that can be owned and bought and valuated, put on the marketplace. And of course, the relationship with indigenous peoples, this has a lot to do with that relationship. And that's my big theme. Of course, it's a big part of the history of capitalism. Karl Marx was quite interested in the history of capitalism. The history of capitalism is a big subject for historians, and I've tried to contribute to it.
What sort of role, how big a role do you think John Cabot and his trip from Bristol to Newfoundland, it was only just a beginning. What sort of happened, I suppose, in the immediate years after that? Because I think initially when ships arrived, they tried to make good relations, friendly relations with the Native Americans. It quite quickly turned sour, though.
Well, the French Empire based its imperial aspirations in the northern part of the continent on the fur trade. So they had to make friends with Indian people. A lot of the British colonization was agriculture based, and it was antagonistic to indigenous peoples. Of course, you know, John Cabot, Christopher Columbus, this early wave of conquistadors, explorers, tried to understand where they were. They were mostly looking for a route to China. I'm quite interested in taking the history a little further. You talked to me about Edward Colston and his important role in the history of your community as a sort of philanthropist who made a lot of money in the slave trade. And I found this drew me into particularly a focus on the restoration, the fact that after 1660, the period when Colston was emerging as a major figure, the British monarchy was reinstated after Cromwell and the Civil War and such. And there was an incredible era of creation of corporations using the power of the crown to create new corporations, like the Corporation of the Carolinas, like the corporation that was handed over to William Penn, and he became the founder of Pennsylvania. The one closest to us here in Canada, the creation of the corporation, and this is all by, you know, Charles the First's son, Charles the First, who had his head cut off, Charles the Second. He sort of seizes upon this power of creating corporations, and so the Hudson's Bay Company sort of steps in where the French have been, and this idea of a fur trade with the Indians. Of course, in order to do that, you have to have fairly friendly relations with the Indian people. Nevertheless, how is it that Charles II simply hands over a great chunk of the world to his cousin Rupert, Rupert's land, all the land drained by waters flowing into Hudson's Bay, which is a huge part, say two-thirds of what exists in Canada now, of the territorial base of Canada. You know, this is an interesting question. How
I'd like to just throw in something there. I'd like to just throw something in there because, of course, Prince Rupert in the Civil War in the 1640s had been a major royalist commander right through the Civil War. So it may have been simply, you know, here's his reward.
Yeah, that's what it is. Obviously, the crown found a source of patronage. You know, already the East India Company had shown the riches available for that kind of enterprise. And actually, Charles II, he seizes on the idea of Greenwich, and says, well, let's make that the basis of longitude. And, you know, eventually that decision reflects and is projected into, you know, how time is calculated and where you start the clock and in the different time zones as you create time zones. I mean, there was a lot of creativity coming from the monarchy in that period. Pennsylvania, which is a creation of Charles II, I mean, William Penn was a Quaker. Society of Friends, he actually said, well, it's not good enough to just get a grant from the English king to create this colony. I have to go to the Indian nations, much like Roger Williams, who founded Rhode Island. He went to the Indian nations and said, give me some kind of charter, give me some kind of permission to create this colony. And this was the basis of Indian treaties, you know, and Indian treaties are still being negotiated in Canada, in, for instance, British Columbia. So in looking into Edward Colston and this period of the restoration of the monarchy, one of the first things that the new Charles II does, he sends his brother to take over New Netherlands and create it as New York, to take over the Dutch colony, the New Netherlands, New Amsterdam, New York, and he, in the process, they kind of take over the relations with the Haudenosaunee, the League of the Iroquois, the kind of protocol of relations, and there's a very interesting saga of sort of creative diplomacy of the British Empire with that particular group of Iroquoian people, but especially the Mohawks, and it turns out that, you know, they become very close to the crown and fight on the British side in the era of the American Revolution. Well, what is this American Revolution? Where does that come from? This becomes a big subject for me in my research.
What about today, though, with Native Americans? I mean, maybe you can give us your rough estimate of the genocide, the number of Native Americans that were killed, and what's the situation for them in the U.S. and Canada today?
Yes, well, if we want to talk about the genocide, I would say, well, let's put the beginning of this genocidal process in 1492. Of course, the Spanish Empire, shortly after that, the Portuguese Empire, which is the basis of today's Brazil. I mean, they are notorious for their conquistadors, for pillaging and raping and seizing gold and enslaving Indian people.
But hang on, Anthony. When you're talking about the conquistadors, there seems to be some pretty strong evidence that the rule in South America, some of the empires that were there, were extremely unpopular amongst the people that lived there, and that when the conquistadors arrived, that they were actually welcomed by some people and given all the information, the conquistadors were given all the information they needed to overthrow those empires.
Well, of course, this is the basis of imperialism. This is the basis of empire building, divide and conquer. And there was a plenty of opportunity for that. Cortez, his mistress, Malinche, gave him a lot of very important information about this group, disliking that group. And you could play on this. I mean, think of the era where the U.S. Army is trying to track down Geronimo, you know, the famous Apache resistance fighter, and they work with Apache scouts. They hire Apaches to help with tracking down another Apache. This divide and conquer, you know, is a basic tactic of imperialism, and it was basic to the European colonization of the Americas. The Aztec were, you know, in a very kind of fragile position at the pinnacle of a complex power network, and the Spanish effectively exploited that. But in so doing and overturning, you know, very major civilizations with a lot of scientific knowledge and a lot of their own insights into agriculture, into, you know, irrigation, into all kinds of subjects that, you know, we would be stronger as humanity if, rather than pillaging those societies, we had looked at them in more egalitarian terms and tried to understand one another and study one another rather than, you know, convert, you know, simply say, well, you're all wrong, your religion is all wrong, you must take our religion. I mean, it's established patterns which continue today. So when we talk about genocide, the genocide that took place in the Western Hemisphere is kind of unparalleled. Some estimate that maybe 100 million Native people met their deaths prematurely, you know, in the opening phases of this, and it never really ended. I mean, Ojibwe language, Native languages in Canada, they have no real official status. The official languages are English and French. The marginalization of Indigenous peoples in the Americas has been, you know, very extreme, less so in Central and South America, where, you know, a vast majority of the population are actually mestizo and have Indian ancestors and identified to some extent as Indigenous peoples. But in North America, you have a very sort of concentrated, dramatic episode of sort of settler colonization. And when the United States was created, you know, the Declaration of Independence, in pointing out the alleged crimes of King George, the author of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, he specified that one of the key crimes of King George was to bring on the merciless Indian savages, whose known means of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. I mean, this could be interpreted as the creation of the global war on terror, the sort of roots of the global war on terror. They're merciless Indian savages. Their known means of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. In other words, they do indiscriminate violence against men, women, children. They are not to be included in the concept of, you know, the equality of humanity, the idea that there is a universal system of human rights, which sort of is the reputation that the American Declaration of Independence gets.
You've pointed out that there are some similarities between Geronimo and Osama bin Laden. I'd be interested if you could just clarify that.
Well, when Osama bin Laden was supposedly hunted down by Navy SEALs in 2011, his code name in the military establishment was Geronimo. And so that was how he was spoken about sort of in professional circles. And so these two personalities are sort of merged. And of course, I think it's a kind of a tall tale that the real Osama bin Laden was hunted down sort of Wild West style, dead or alive. I mean, if you're going to apprehend the person who you say is the most integral, you know, knowledgeable terrorist in history, in the whole system, you might want to take some care to apprehend him in a way that you could ask him some questions and pick his mind about what he knew. But no, the story was 2011, they're going to hunt down bin Laden, and they end up burying him at sea. That's the story. Well, as I see it, what this really was all about was, you know, the 10th anniversary of 9/11. There was going to be a trial in New York of Khaled Sheikh Mohammed, the supposed mastermind of 9/11. That sort of broke down. We don't really have trials concerning what really happened on 9/11. So this hunt down of Bin Laden, who is codenamed Geronimo, this becomes a kind of opportunity for Obama's administration, you know, new to the White House, to kind of turn the page and invent its own version of the global war on terror and continue the narrative, but it's with its own sort of democratic twist.
One of the things I found so
party twist.
One of the things I found so shocking, really, about the killing of Bin Laden by SEAL Team Six, if I can say it, was that the many of those soldiers subsequently died in all sorts of strange. Well, I think there was one main circumstance where a helicopter crashed or something, and many of them never lived to tell anyone about it. Also, we had the dumping of Bin Laden's body at sea. Many people have suggested that actually Bin Laden died, but actually back in 2001, potentially out of kidney disease. So the whole thing could be a complete fantasy set up and just injected fake news, basically, for the public. We saw famously a picture of the cabinet, the US cabinet, looking around under, I think it was under Obama, watching this happen. And everyone is supposedly watching as it's happening, but we're never allowed to see the screen. So this photo itself could just be a psyop. I mean, what do you make of that whole incident?
Well, the idea of burying Bin Laden at sea, in other words, he's gone, he's whisked out of, you know, any material existence, there's no credible evidence that it was actually him, this deception, and of course the deception around Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda as the culprits of 9/11, this is part of a, you know, huge deception. It's so, you know, monumental in scale to deal with 9/11, this early story that we were told basically within hours that it somehow Bin Laden was responsible. Then within a couple of days, it's 19 people with box cutters. Very soon, even the BBC goes out and finds that many of these people that supposedly hijacked and crashed these planes were found to be living and whatnot. So the whole myth of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, I mean, this goes back to Afghanistan. This goes back to the effort to overthrow the Soviet-backed regime in Afghanistan and creating Al-Qaeda and a kind of foreign legion, a sort of Islamic foreign legion, and funding this creation and funneling money through ISI in Pakistan. You know, the CIA working closely with ISI in Pakistan. And then, of course, after 9/11, Al-Qaeda becomes, you know, very important in U.S. operations in Bosnia, in the Balkans. And, you know, even Al-Qaeda even shows up in Syria, and it's sort of under a new name. So there is the U.S. government and other governments helping Al-Qaeda supposedly to overthrow the Assad regime in Syria. But wait a minute now. Weren't we told that Al-Qaeda did 9/11? Well, we know the government helped Al-Qaeda, in fact, kind of created Al-Qaeda with recruiting, with funding, before 9/11 in the Afghanistan situation. And so this creation of the imagery of Bin Laden as sort of chief terrorist number one, a CIA agent who was, you know, in dialysis in July in, was it Dubai, you know, just a couple of months before 9/11, visiting with the CIA because he had urinary problems. Yes, I think it's, you know, most credible that Bin Laden didn't live too long after 9/11.
Now, and, just a minute. One other aspect of Bin Laden is that the SEAL Team 6 crash. Some of the families say, and this is a report in the Washington Times, families suspect SEAL Team 6 crash was an inside job on the worst day in Afghanistan. I'll put a link up to that on our show page. That's on October the 20th, 2013. So they feel apparently that someone was involved in that. This was some sort of attack on a Chinook helicopter by someone within the American Security Service themselves. But let's not dwell too much on Bin Laden. I think it's great, fascinating that, to see the parallels between Geronimo then and now. Well, I mean, what does what happened in the colonization of America tell us? What you've learnt about the military-industrial complex today, about where this war on terror is heading? Because it does seem to have hit a bit of a brick wall in Syria. We're just hearing literally this week about US troops being pulled out of Syria. This was on Wesley Clark's list of countries that they wanted to take over, 7 countries in 5 years. Now I'm afraid the Russian Federation are very firmly ensconced, being invited in by Assad of Syria. Those Russian bases at Tarsus, etc., it looks like they're staying. So what do you think of the apparent brick wall that this war on terror has now hit 18 years after, or 17 years after it started with those 9/11 attacks, attempting really to set the scene for the whole of the 21st century, this war on terror now grinding to a halt, Anthony?
Well, whether it's grinding to a halt, I think that would be premature to say that. We've got so many balls up in the air. Let me try to make sense of this. When you talk about the convenient disappearance of the Navy SEAL team that supposedly took out Bin Laden, I mean, we see a lot of this in false flag terrorism. Just recently in Strasbourg, there are the yellow vests, you know, building up their credibility, building up their momentum, and suddenly there's a terrorist event, an Islamic terrorist goes haywire in Strasbourg, and sort of takes the wind out of the sails of this movement. I mean, how many of these episodes do the people who could give evidence end up dead? There's nobody to give testimony. There's no basis for future trials. The disappearance of people is incredible. I mean, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that on 9/11 we began to be immersed into a kind of dark ages. And one of the early things that happened was to rev up the torture chambers. And, they didn't actually chase down Al-Qaeda. They rounded up a lot of Muslim people and Arab people who didn't have their passports in order. So they were able to fill jails with, brown-skinned people who were Muslim, but they didn't deal with, for instance, the urban moving system of Israelis, two of which were said to be Mossad, who, you know, were filming the event on the morning of 9/11. The spies, the dozens of spies that were picked up, Israeli spies, they were all sent home to Israel. Al-Qaeda wasn't really tracked down, but you had a sort of random collection of Islamic and Arab people. So this 9/11 episode, look at the way the internet is going. Look at the way we're being censored. Look at the surveillance state. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that we were plunged into a kind of dark age. I mean, what I went through here in University of Lethbridge in Alberta, you know, where I'm talking as I talk, and suddenly I've got the Israel lobby on my case, you know, writing stories about me that somehow it's hateful to, you know, try to keep a critical perspective on what's really going on and to speak to some of the biggest, hardest issues of war and peace, life and death in our time. You know, how many millions of people killed in Iraq? The crimes against humanity, the lack of accountability, the fact that we don't get investigations into anything. I remember the time of Watergate, Iran-Contra, the Church Commission. I mean, we have investigations that sort of go up into the late 1980s. But after 9/11, everything is just under a veil. And those who talk about these things, it is dangerous to do so. I'm 67 years old. I'm recently retired, but I went through an episode here. We've talked about it. You know, you look at Vanderpeel, he makes a little tweet and suddenly...
Hey, this is, you're talking about the international relations professor, Kees van der Peel at Sussex University, the Dutch guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you look at the experience of Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, it's just not seen to be acceptable in very, in certain circles of power and influence that you say anything critical about Israel and treatment of Palestinians. Now, very early on, Netanyahu was saying 9/11 was good for Israel because people will empathize with us. And now it's very common for the Israeli government to speak about Palestinians basically as terrorists. And this word terrorism is so used so flippantly to discredit people. Corrupt regimes in power everywhere, they regularly refer to their opponents as terrorists. We just can't get the context anymore for rational discussions based on evidence. And, so this is why I say that we're in, a dark age, and we can talk about the kind of ridiculous scenario presented to us that the Navy SEALs hunt down Bin Laden, Geronimo, as if he's some kind of desperado in the Wild West. Only it's Abbott's, only it's in Pakistan, and the idea of burying the guy at, in the ocean, as if this is somehow reflective of Muslim heritage and religion. I mean, it's one absurd story after the next.
Anyway, look, you just brought up the Israel lobby there, and it just so happens that I met up with a guy from New York originally. He's now settled in the UK with his wife, and he's moved to Bristol recently. His name is Rob Mendel, and here he is talking to me early this week about that transatlantic Israel lobby.
It operates not only officially in terms of groups that are recognized as lobbyists, but it's the lobby basically has support among informally among Jewish groups. For example, I'll just give you another in California, Angela Davis was supposed to be awarded something in recognition by the Civil Rights Institute in California.
So who is she?
Angela Davis is an African-American leader in the late 1960s and 70s and has written on black feminism and has been she was a member of the Communist Party at one stage and then left after the Communist Party basically fell apart, after the Soviet Union collapsed. And Jewish groups in California put pressure on the Institute to withdraw the invitation. So she's now been denied being recognized as being an advocate of civil rights. And her statement was very interesting. She said, I don't take this personally. I don't think it's undermining me, but it's basically undermining all those who are fighting for social justice. You have in universities attempts basically to silence anyone who criticizes Israel. There are 26 states in the United States which have passed or are considering passing laws to prohibit the advocacy of boycott, disinvestment, and sanctions. 26 states.
Amazing.
And even in Congress right now, there is some discussion of passing a law to criminalize BDS.
Well, that's the precise campaign which was so successful in South Africa.
That's exactly right. So that's how the lobby works. The lobby works. The lobby, in some sense, it's not a conspiracy. It's basically it's getting the word out that certain things are off limits, certain things are illegitimate, and you have a consensus, unfortunately, within the both parties, Democrats and Republicans, maybe with a few exceptions of the Democrats, who see Israel basically as being a beacon of democracy, but the outpost of civilization in the Middle East, and will never question Israel.
Now, I've read a few articles the last couple of months, a couple comparing the whole 1950s McCarthyism you know, are you a communist? Have you ever been a member of a communist party? To the way that anti-Semitism is being treated nowadays. Is that something that you think that's a bit of a comparison too far, or is that...
No, I think that's an apt analogy. I think that's, you know, very insightful, actually. And it's a way of silencing people, people who put their heads above the parapet and just, you know, questioning the practices of a state and holding them accountable to international conventions and international law, and basically trying to cow them. And anyone who basically advocates BDS is seen to be anti-Semitic. And I don't see that as, you know, I think you could be, there's a very strong Jewish tradition. I remember going to Hebrew school. I went to Hebrew school for 3 years in the United States. And we were always told that we had a moral duty to speak out against social injustice, no matter where we saw it and no matter who was perpetuating it. So it's a very strong ethical and moral tradition within Judaism, which I hold dear. So I don't see there's any contradiction in being a Jew and being critical of Israel. And as a Jew, I could say that. And I could say there are Christians, likewise, the Judeo-Christian tradition, who would likewise basically be compelled to speak out against injustice. And I don't see that as being anti-Semitic.
What about the confusion, you might call it, between the Jewish identity as a racial thing and as a religion? Because I think for some people that is difficult to untangle. The two seem to have been mixed together somehow.
That's exactly right. I think the turning point, because if you look at the history or the evolution of Zionism, Zionism was a minor undercurrent within the Jewish communities, both in this country and the United States, after the Holocaust. The Holocaust basically was the turning point. Until the Holocaust, most Jews were assimilating or acculturating in the societies they lived in. The immigrants who came from Russia and Eastern Europe to this country, the United States, they adopted new homelands, whether it be Britain or the United States, and they settled. You know, and they thought themselves as being British or American. The Holocaust was the turning point, because then Zionism attains kind of the higher terrain, basically, and gains legitimacy.
At the same time, just afterwards, anyway, it got land too.
That's exactly right. Exactly. So now, I think you're quite right. Most Jews were identified with the State of Israel. So it's very tricky, and this is really difficult, to separate out the Jewish identity from the State of Israel. Because for many Jews who are secular, they're not religious, right? They strongly identify with Israel because they see that as basically a source of pride, a source of empowerment, a source of security and so forth. So it's very difficult to kind of separate those things out. I mean, I don't see being a Jew a nationality. You know, Judaism is a religion, you know? So I don't see...
But you talk about yourself as Jewish.
Yes.
Are you religious? You go to synagogue every Saturday?
No. You know, I followed Ernest Hemingway's, you know, adage. You know, when he was a devout Catholic, and he said, "If you're a Catholic, and either you practice Catholicism or you break altogether." And it's the same thing as a Jew. I went to synagogue for 3 years. You know, my mother kept a kosher home, but I broke from it. You know, but again, it's still part of my cultural, you know, DNA. You know, you can't simply just disavow everything that you were, you know.
No, and you wouldn't necessarily want to. There are certain parts of it you want to hang on to.
Exactly.
So that was that. I was just speaking there with Ron Mendel, who's just arrived here in Bristol from Northampton and originally from New York. I mean, what do you make of what he was saying there about the Israel lobby, Tony?
Well, there's been some big revelations about the Israel lobby in action. For instance, the Al Jazeera documentaries. There's one on UK, four-part series, and there's a four-part series on the lobby, the Israel lobby, USA. And it was kept from the airwaves of Al Jazeera. The government of Qatar was subject to Zionist pressure, and it didn't get broadcast there. But it did get posted on Electronic Intifada, and it's available on Electronic Intifada. And it focuses a lot on the treatment of BDS and the how afraid people are in Israel, that the younger generation is turning against, not necessarily turning against Israel, but not as loyal as they might have been in the past. And so the idea of taking action on campus to prevent this trend, and that focus of campus activity is boycott, divestments, and sanctions, BDS campaign, and this becomes the target of a lot of pressure, and this pressure comes directly from the Israeli government, and that's one of the revelations of this documentary, who work with these organizations on the various campuses, the Zionist organizations on the various campuses, and the Israeli government makes available, you know, software, spyware. They develop files on people and are able to blackmail people, intimidate people, use information garnered on the internet in various ways. It's a very important documentary and is available at Electronic Intifada. The guest you had on is speaking of, you know, injustice. When you see injustice, well, to me, the great injustice of the lies and crimes of 9/11, it's this smearing, it's this blackening the name and the image and the reputation of all Islamic people on earth, the Ummah. And you come up again and again in face with this term Islamophobia, you know, fear of Muslims. And so that was definitely how 9/11 was presented to us. This was a crime of Muslim extremists, with Osama bin Laden as a, you know, major personification of extremists who hate our freedoms, who have a kind of irrational hatred of the West.
Well, this is really propaganda, actually, I would argue, Anthony. This is propaganda. We've seen something quite recently, just before Christmas, it was allowed, it was printed in the British papers. There's something called the Integrity Initiative here in the UK. It was a little office based in an old derelict mill in Scotland, which had got something like £2 million worth of money from the Foreign Office, and they had a guide. They were publishing a guide to countering Russian disinformation. That was what they were supposed to be doing. Really, of course, it's a propaganda outfit, but they were also smearing Jeremy Corbyn in their tweets as well. So what they've done is they've tried to shut down their Twitter account by protecting it. In other words, making so that only the people they want to see their tweets can see them. But I've been sent an extract from their report, a guide to countering Russian disinformation. A whole load of information about myself. It says, a British so-called expert, in inverted commas, who frequently appears on Russia Today, although I haven't for over 3 years now, is Tony Gosling. Even though he's described as a historian, he has never taught history, nor written any books about it. In fact, his views on history are driven by a conspiracy theory which holds a secret society within the Freemasons called the Illuminati, which, in brackets, which briefly existed in Bavaria in the late 18th century, close brackets, controls most world events today. His views were exposed in 2015 in an article by Adam Holland on the Daily Beast website. Russia Today has an Illuminati correspondent, really? Well, this is a complete and utter misrepresentation of my views. I have a part history degree. I've written many articles on history. I've looked very deeply into the English Civil War, into the Second World War and elsewhere. So this is really just total disinformation and lies being paid for with public money. I find it pretty shocking. But look, before we look at the go into some of the up-to-date things with Trump and the wall, Anthony, with you, I'd like you to give us your takes, particularly since you're from Canada, on this incredible arrest of Meng Wanzhou from the Huawei, because this is an enormous provocation against the Chinese. The idea that if someone from China trades with Iran, that then it's okay for one of the United States' proxies up in Canada to arrest them. It's pretty incredible, and it's been an enormous spin-off with scores of people being arrested by the Chinese, and we hear this week someone in Poland being arrested from Huawei too.
Yes, this is a major story. I think it's not an overstatement to say that Meng Wanzhou, the arrest of Meng Wanzhou in Vancouver by the Canadian government, amounts to a kind of act of war. This woman is the daughter of the equivalent of Steve Jobs in China, you know, a very celebrated family. When do we see top executives in major corporations getting, you know, publicly arrested on airplanes and such? I mean, we went through the whole financial debacle of 2008 and all the criminality at the high levels of the banking regime and all the payouts and bailouts and quantitative easing, the handing over of trillions of dollars, in scam after scam after scam in the era of financial deregulation. And then along comes this arrest, this high-profile arrest by Canada. And, you know, many people in Canada are saying Justin Trudeau is in over his head. He doesn't, you know, he's not like his father. He's not a well-educated person. This was a bad move on his part. And now Canadians are being arrested in China and held in custody. And obviously it's a bit of a response. If you're going to do this to our people in China, this is going to be the response. I mean, let's consider the strategic importance of what company emerges at the peak of the sort of cell phone digital device chain of command, feeding order. I mean, it's of enormous significance. Much of the spying takes place on these devices, the surveillance, and the idea that she was arrested because a company, not the big company, but a smaller company in Hong Kong doing business with, what is it, Hongwei, the big cell phone company, a company connected to that company did business with Iran. And, you know, how is it in the interests of Canada or the United States or Britain to demonize Iran? And how, you know, where do these sanctions come from? John Bolton seemed to be the operative in the U.S. government putting pressure on the Canadian government. John Bolton is generally seen as a kind of an extension of Sheldon Adelson, who has a great deal of power in the Republican Party, including over the president, you know, through the vast financial contributions he makes. And we're in an era of Citizens United where money, the power of money, is sort of completely unrestrained in the U.S. Political system. So this can be conceived as an act of war taken, and it's being taken very, very seriously in China. And of course, part of the sort of mismanagement of our governments in this sort of dark era of the global war on terror is that, you know, how are we going to align internationally the global superpowers? And, you know, if Russia and China are pulled together, that's not good for the United States. Where does the European Union fit in all of this? Is it an adjunct of US power?
Perfect cue to talk about Ukraine here, because the border there is tense, certainly, but there is an agreement called the Minsk Agreement, which has really calmed down things greatly. And I wanted to play this to you, Anthony, because I was so shocked to hear on the World Service that BBC's Jonah Fisher talking about an interesting event which took place last weekend, which was the splitting of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church from the Orthodox Church in general. So they're going to have their own independent Orthodox Church. But he said something which is, I thought, incredible, which is that effectively Russia and Ukraine are at war, which they're not. And also he talks, the interesting part of his report, he talks about the potential problems with the Russian Orthodox Church. You have lots of monasteries still right across Ukraine, and that they may be deliberately shut down or closed down by the Ukrainian government. So let's have a listen to Jonah Fisher now and see if you laughed as much as I did when I heard him talk about this so-called war going on between Ukraine and Russia.
Petro Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president, is there. He is clearly keen to use this moment of victory for all it's worth. There's an election due here in 3 months' time, and he's doing badly in the opinion poll. So he is no doubt hoping that placing himself at the centre of this will boost his own political prospects. I think if we ask ourselves the question, why is this happening now, we have to look at the fact that effectively Russia and Ukraine are at war with each other. 4 years ago, Russia seized Crimea from Ukraine, and at this very moment in time, a war is continuing in eastern Ukraine in which rebels that are being backed by Russia are fighting the Ukrainian army. So I think both on the global level, in terms of what other countries thought about Ukraine having its own independent church, that helped push us to this moment. And domestically here in Ukraine as well, I think many people who perhaps didn't have a strong feeling about whether Ukraine's church should be officially recognized or not, the conflict in the east in particular, I think has driven many people and pushed public opinion here to feel that the time had really come for Ukraine to complete that breakaway and to have its own fully independent and fully recognized Orthodox church. What happens to the churches and monasteries here which remain under the control of the Russian Orthodox Church? There are about 12,000 parishes which are controlled by the Russian Orthodox Church. As part of this decision, they don't simply get swapped over and handed over to this newly independent Ukrainian Orthodox Church. There are many people here who would, of course, like that to happen, but they do remain under the control of the Russian Orthodox Church for now. I think what people are concerned about is that perhaps there might be moves made to take over these monasteries by force. There might be efforts made to push out the monks, the priests from the Russian Orthodox Church. And if that does happen, well, there is of course the potential for conflict, and of course there is also the potential that Russia may feel particularly insulted by any move in that way, and in a sort of worst case scenario, they might feel Moscow might feel that it might have to intervene in some way to protect these churches that are controlled by the Russian Orthodox Church.
Well, the last half of his report was quite good. Fascinating, actually. But that was Jonah Fisher from the BBC giving fake news, Anthony, of a ongoing war between between Russia and Ukraine. Now, what do you think is the reality of the situation there? He's talking about Russia having seized Crimea.
Well, Crimea was, the base of the Russian Navy, the important transit point. It's very connected to Russia. The majority of people in Crimea want to be part of Russia. Was it Khrushchev attached Crimea to Ukraine in 1954 in some inexplicable action? What I focused in on was, suddenly this emphasis on the Byzantine Church and the various branches of the Byzantine Church, and would there be a Ukrainian Byzantine Church? That's part of the era of the global war on terror, the post-9/11 era. In the 20th century, we were becoming more and more secular. But suddenly this 9/11 had built into its sort of propaganda structure all this emphasis on religion, and this grew out of the Clash of Civilizations thesis by Samuel Huntington, which put all this emphasis on religion. So using religion as a tactic of propaganda, as a
I'll tell you what I think it is. I think he's absolutely desperate. He's only at 8% in the polls, and he'd try anything in order to get a bit of sympathy. But look, listen, before we finish at the top of the hour, Anthony, I must play you a little clip from Bernie Sanders this week, and let's just finish on looking at Trump on the wall, because the distraction technique seems to be what Trump is up to here. So let's have a listen to he's the guy who ran against Hillary Clinton, who was robbed of the Democratic nomination. So many people say, including our own Martin Summers here on many occasions, has said Bernie Sanders, really, if there was any real democracy in the United States, should be the president right now. So this is his reaction to the Oval Office speech about the wall.
Thank you very much for joining me this evening. President Trump has stated tonight and over again in recent weeks that this country faces a national emergency. Well, he's right. But it is an emergency and a crisis that he himself has created. As we speak, some 800,000 federal employees, people who are our neighbors, friends and family members are going without pay. As working people, many of them are wondering how they will pay their mortgages, how they will feed their kids, and how they'll be able to go to the doctor. These are the people in the FBI, in the TSA, in the State Department, in the Treasury Department, and other agencies who have, in some cases, worked for the federal government for decades. Let me just quote what one federal employee has said. Just one. Quote, "I am a single mom and a federal employee. I have $100 to last me, and my vehicle payments will not be made this month. I live paycheck to paycheck, and I can't get a side job because I still have to go to my unpaid federal job." End of quote. And she speaks for thousands of federal employees. Our federal employees deserve to be treated with respect, not held hostage as political pawns. Further, if this government shutdown continues, and Trump has indicated that he is prepared to shut it down for months, if not years, millions of Americans, including the disabled, the children, and the elderly, may not be able to get the food stamps they need to eat. Pregnant mothers and their babies may go without the nutrition assistance they need to stay healthy as the WIC program is on the verge of running out of money. Small businesses and farmers will not be able to receive the financial assistance they need, and some may go out of business. Security at our nation's airports could be threatened if TSA employees and air control traffic controllers are not getting paid. People who are buying or selling their homes may see significant delays because the Federal Housing Administration is unable to process and approve mortgage applications. Let me be as clear as I can be. This shutdown should never have happened. As many of you will recall, on December 19th, the U.S. Senate voted unanimously to keep the government open. Unanimously. No Democrat or Republican opposed the bill that passed the Senate. It was widely expected that the following morning, December 20th, the House would do the same and the government would remain open. Unfortunately, President Trump, who started receiving criticism from an assortment of right-wing ideologues, changed his mind about the agreement and said that he would not sign any bill unless it included $5.7 billion for a wall on the southern border. And by the way, the total cost of that wall could run as high as $70 billion. In terms of this shutdown, President Trump has made it very clear who is responsible. As you will all recall, in a very public meeting he held in the Oval Office, he said, and I quote, this is quoting Donald Trump, quote, "I am proud to shut down the government. I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you, Chuck Schumer, for it." End of quote. On January 3rd, 2019, on their first day in the majority, the Democrats in the House passed legislation to reopen the government. This was exactly the same bill unanimously passed by the Senate. Tonight, I urge Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to allow that bill to come to the floor for a vote. This is the same bill that Mr. McConnell supported when it was unanimously passed in the Senate. Senator McConnell, let's vote to end this shutdown now in a bipartisan way. President Trump tonight has told us why he believes we need the wall. It gives me no pleasure to tell you what most of you already know, and that is that President Trump lies all of the time. And in his remarks tonight and in recent weeks regarding immigration and the wall, he continues to lie. Just a few examples. Trump has told the American people several hundred times, and he mentioned it tonight, that Mexico would pay for the wall. That's a lie. If this wall were to be built, Mexico would not pay for it. American taxpayers would. Trump said that thousands and thousands of terrorists are entering the United States from the southern border. That is also a lie. According to a State Department report released in September, quote, at year's end, there was no credible evidence indicating that international terrorist groups have sent operatives via Mexico into the United States, end of quote. That's not Bernie Sanders' opinion. That is a direct quote from Trump's own State Department. Trump recently said that some ex-presidents told him that they should have built a wall. That is a lie. All four living ex-presidents have stated clearly that they never talked to Trump about their desire to build a wall. Trump said that we need a wall to prevent heroin, fentanyl, and other illegal drugs from coming into the country. Another lie. According to Donald Trump's own Drug Enforcement Administration, the most common method Mexican cartels use to transport illegal drugs over the southwest border is through legal ports of entry using passenger vehicles. And on it goes. In terms of immigration in this country, what we need to do is not to waste billions of dollars on a wall, but to finally address the need for comprehensive immigration reform, including improved border security. It is inhumane that tiny children at the border have been torn away from their parents. It is disgraceful that 1.8 million young people raised in the United States and who know no other country but the United States have lost their legal protection under the DACA program because of Trump's actions. It is heartbreaking that almost 11 million undocumented people living in this country, the overwhelming majority of whom are hardworking and law-abiding, worry every day about being deported and separated from their loved ones. Sadly, what President Trump is trying to do is to create fear and hatred in our country. Instead of trying to bring us together as a people, he is trying to divide us up. And in the process, divert our attention away from the real crises facing the working families of this nation. President Trump, you want to talk about crises? At a time of massive income and wealth inequality, tens of millions of our workers are earning starvation wages and are unable to adequately provide for their families. That's a crisis. You want to talk about a national emergency? 30 million Americans have no health insurance, and many more are underinsured. Thousands die each year because they don't go to a doctor when they should. And our life expectancy in this country is actually in decline. While the pharmaceutical industry makes tens of billions of dollars a year in profit, one in five Americans can't afford the medicine they need. Now that is a crisis we should be working on right now. And here's another crisis. Too many of our seniors are living in desperate poverty, and about half of older Americans have no retirement savings. Hundreds of thousands of young people cannot afford to go to college in this country, and over 40 million are trying to deal with the outrageous levels of student debt they are experiencing. What are we going to do about those crises? And maybe here's the biggest crisis of all. The scientific community has made it very clear in telling us that climate change is real and is causing devastating harm to our country and the entire planet. And they have told us, in no uncertain terms, that if we do not transform our energy system away from fossil fuel, our nation and our planet, and the planet we will be leaving our kids and grandchildren, may well become unhealthy and even uninhabitable in the not-so-distant future. Mr. President, we don't need to create artificial crises. We have enough real crises. Let us end this shutdown and bring the American people together around an agenda that will improve life for all of our people.
So that's Bernie Sanders' reaction to Trump's Oval Office speech. Anthony Hall, what do you make
of it? Well, I think this is an indicator of this kind of dark age that we've fallen into, and this divide and conquer, you know, making the wall, a symbol of division between peoples, the basis of a historic
about the shutdown, though? Isn't this actually just making no government, which is kind of what the Republicans want anyway? The idea really being to hand over the government to big business and the banksters.
Well, there's that, but let's remember, in the global war on terror, big government is listening to us, spying on us, spending all kinds of money to do war. I mean, Republicans...
Sorry, we have to leave it there. Anthony, we're going to have to leave it there. Time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. That was Professor Anthony Hall, author of Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization and Capitalism. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Martin Summers will be back, we hope, in March. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week.